Okay, thank you all for coming to the CAD modeling update from Jeremy and Nick. Jeremy joined JLTRE in December 2012 as head of analytics ANZ based in Sydney. He has over 20 years industry experience in reinsurance underwriting and broking, both in the UK and Australia. Jeremy was the chief pricing actuary for Amlin and developed many bespoke pricing and risk analysis tools. He has authored several papers aimed at how to understand the uncertainties within CAT models in order to satisfy their pre-regulations. Nicholas is the catastrophe modelling leader for QBE Australia and New Zealand, based in Sydney. He has worked in the insurance industry for 12 years, primarily in CAT exposure management, both in Australia and the London market. Prior to joining QBE, Nicholas worked at Aon, Navigator, Zurich and Aviva. He has experience of modelling CATs for various lines of business, including property, marine, and offshore energy. Thank you. Hand over to Jeremy.
Right, let's get straight into it. It's a team approach. So this is an information note that we're producing on behalf of the Institute of Actuaries, where we've got a specialist select team there, where we've not quite finished the note and we're still working on it. So any feedback you've got on what we've done or what you'd like to know more about would be very helpful. We've got a range of different kind of backgrounds of insurance, reinsurance and broking. It's a difficult task, but it's well needed, especially in Australia where CAT risk is significant. The note aims to assist actuaries in this role. So what we noticed when we first got going is that CAT modelling is a bottomless pit of detail. So what we've done deliberately in the note is try not to go into too much detail because there's plenty of literature, but give you enough to allow you to begin challenging these models and allow you to certain regulatory requirements, make sure you've got enough information to be armed with the ability to challenge the models. So this is the purpose of the note, really, to help actuaries. But CAT models have been around since about 1992, post-Hurricane Andrew, where prior to that, a bit of a benign CAT season, CAT models weren't really established, and they can produce some very large numbers. But the APRA regulation, I wonder if that's our bell for beginning, in which case, maybe I'll hang on a second. I'll just hang on a little bit. Okay, so as I was saying, the CAT models began roughly in 1992, where they produced some very large numbers that weren't necessarily believed, because in the past 10 years, no one had seen a number anything like that. But with the APRA guidance of a 1 in 200 all perils and 3 1 in 10s, 4 1 in 6s, it's actually very hard to do that without a model, to be honest, especially a 1 in 200, which is quite an extreme event. And you know, I work quite a lot with CAT models and CAT modelers, and I have seen a range of answers. It can range off the data that we might use. It can range off the models we might use. It can... It's almost separating signal from noise, that the models can have differences of opinion on the riskiness of certain types of buildings. And there's real uncertainty there. So what we're trying to do in this note is to give you a bit of a background of the kind of things that you can be thinking about. Because CAT modelling is inherently complex, because the underlying phenomenon is actually complex too. So and it's not a guidance note. It's mainly meant to be sort of best practice. So we do cover a range of things. And it might be a bit much to do everything, but it's meant to give you guidance of the kind of things that you could do. I like to think of it, CAT models are complex, just like a weather model. A weather prediction model might be complex, but you don't necessarily need to understand the nuts and bolts of the climate model to know whether or not to take an umbrella. So what we're trying to do is give you enough guidance to work out whether it's a reasonable thing to do, the set of numbers that you've just seen. So this presentation, I'm not going to go through the note in massive detail, because if you're interested, do read the note. We've not quite finished. We're going to do a little bit more on other ways of assessing the risk. The note's got some references, so if you want even more detail, there's quite a lot of good literature out there to allow you to become really interested in CAT modelling. So a few of the sessions have been about how actuaries can get more on the front foot and get away perhaps from regulatory positions. This is perhaps one way of delving in. I certainly know there's a few actuaries around that are really good at CAT modelling. One of them sat in the audience here. Then what I'm going to do is try and take a little bit beyond the note, aiming to keep it pragmatic and perhaps see how it applies in practice. And then Nick's going to give us a bit of an example from QB about how it might apply. And I will draw your attention to the bit at the end here where often the appointed actuary might be a third line of defence, and it's ultimately the board's decision. But what actuaries can do is, we think active questioning is perhaps a good way to make sure that the right processes and procedures and risk measurement things have been taken into account. So I'll take you through some of that. And I like to think it's a bit like driving a car versus being a mechanic, that we can still make good use of the numbers we see from an outside point of view without necessarily lifting the bonnet up and start tinkering with the pieces. Personally, I don't know what I'm doing with my car. I would take it to go and see I wouldn't take it to see a cat modeller. But the point I'm making is that there can be quite complex in between. There might be things and interactions in there that we're perhaps not aware of. So what we do in the note is we refer to the pieces of guidance. There's a couple of actuarial bits of guidance, a couple of actuary bits of guidance that mention using cat models, whether it be valuations or FCRs. And for APRA, typically capital, horizontal, etc. So there's a lot more detail in the note, but I would suggest that if you're taking on one of these roles to give advice, make sure you're doing what the note says and not what you think the note may say in case of going perhaps to too much detail. That from an actuarial perspective, we do have to rely on another bunch of experts that spend a lot of time doing this. So it's well worth quizzing their brain. And if you're a appointed actuary, perhaps a little bit further away, make sure that the right things have been done. It's not necessarily up to you to do them, but you can point out what needs to be done or what would be a better way of handling that risk. Cat models are, as I've said, necessarily complex, mainly because the phenomenon is complex. There was a court case recently, actually, La Quina in Italy, about a week ago, where there was a tragic earthquake where 309 people lost their lives. And just before that earthquake happened, they flew in the top five earthquake scientists in Italy who, they didn't give advice as such, but they didn't recommend that people were to leave. They actually got convicted of manslaughter. And it was only a week ago where they got let off that conviction. So earthquake modelling is very complex. Even post a wobble with your top five earthquake scientists, it's not easy to say what the impact of that is going to be. And the real holy grail is to get people out of that area and save lives. So the underlying phenomena is actually very complicated. There's lots of parameters. The data that you feed into it may not always be complete. The data for the underlying phenomena might not always be complete. So there's a necessary complexity in what we're trying to achieve here. So the note takes us through some of those areas where there can be differences in models and hopefully gives you some tools and weapons of thinking about, does it make sense? Cat model results are actually very difficult to say if it makes sense based on just the number. So there's almost a way of checking the right things have been done, which we'll go through in a minute. So the main aim is to for an actuary to say, is this modelling okay? Is it appropriate? So we talk about the role of the actuary in this, that if you're the appointed actuary, you, I think, through active questioning, need to assess whether it's reasonable. So active questioning could cover governance. You know, how's the model being handled? How do you handle model changes? The process that you might go through, you know, the data cleansing that we all hear about, how it's dealt with, how it's been codified into the relevant cat models, because the cat models have got lots of different inputs for lots of different kind of buildings, and how's that been done? Is it getting better over time? It could be the model choices that you might make. And I'll go on next about the models that are available. There's not, you know, I say the word accepted, cat models for all perils in all territories, but we need to know what they are and alternative ways of checking it. So I'm specifically referring to what Ian Lachlan calls stress and scenario testing, as well as a valid method for checking or at least doing a sense test of what cat models may be. And then the use of the results, which might be, you know, the loadings that you might apply. So demand surge is a common one, how that might vary by return period. Frequencies of events. If there's a Poisson distribution, are the events independent? Not necessarily. So how's that maybe been dealt with? And then the data quality and governance. So materiality is a key point here, that for some people who perhaps are buying at a 1 in 200, maybe we need to spend a bit more time on the data quality and how wrong it could be. So managing that downside risk through using the models in a particular way to assess the uncertainty of that. So if I quickly go on to the models that are available, Typically, there's three main vendor modeling firms which do earthquake and cyclone pretty well. They all produce different answers, and there can be valid reasons for that. They might have different views on the science, which we'll go on briefly about in a minute, particularly for earthquake, which is my favourite peril. But for Australia as well, bushfire, flood, storm and hail are highly significant to this region, particularly frequency. So particularly the horizontal component of the ICRC. So these, as an actuary, these are particular questions. How might you have handled storm risk? I was just in the El Nino, La Nina one. How has that been handled? Because you know things are going to change in the future year coming forward. The cyclone model might well be out of date because climate change may well be altering the frequency of these things. How has that been thought about or considered? And flood, where not everybody does flood, how has that been dealt with? And the key point here is be prepared to step away from the model, like the police. Step away from the model and have a think. Think about the company and the risk profile and where everything is and what you might want to do about that with a range of techniques we'll talk about in a minute. Bushfire, flood, storm and hail. Over the past 50-odd years, roughly two-thirds of it has been not cyclone and not earthquake. So it's the place where there isn't necessarily accepted vendor models. You know, Australia probably represents 2% of the world GI income. The cat modelling firms can make a lot more money doing Florida than doing Australia. So, but for here, for the horizontal requirements, it can be significant, especially if we think about the ENSO. It could make a difference in terms of buying covers. We can actually see as well that hail is quite a dramatic one over the past 40-odd years. So I've been told recently that the hail 99 loss, which was enormous, around about $4 billion or so, the majority of that was not over Sydney, as in it was out to sea. So disaster scenarios could be, what if that was to be run again, but actually was a bit closer in? So sometimes these numbers can be enormous, especially in terms of frequencies. I'd say that if the conditions are right for one hailstorm, they may well be right for several. If it's hot and dry, you might not just get one bushfire, you may get several. So there will be correlations. You can see that in the data. I'm not necessarily saying that the actuaries necessarily quantify that with a correlation coefficient, but just be aware that you could get two or three. How would your reinsurance or your capital respond to that? How would your pricing respond to that? How many claims would it be? How would your claims handling team respond to that? So yeah, the key point there is two-thirds of it is non-earthquake and cyclone for Australia in general. All cat models work in principle along these same lines. So I think the cat modelling has only recently been introduced to the actuarial education syllabus. So this picture might be familiar to some, but basically there's a hazard module. Now I'd say that's where the uncertainty actually starts. But I'll show you a map in a minute of earthquake. The RMS earthquake hazard map is different to Geoscience Australia's hazard map. And that's because there's differences in opinion on that. So for Australia, you know, we're not on a tectonic plate necessarily, so they may well dig up bits of ground and work out when earthquakes happened and take different views on that science. There's different views of the earthquake risk around Perth. It's perfectly reasonable to have a different view on that science, which then feeds into a model. You've then got your vulnerability, which is primary uncertainty is whether you get an event happening or not. Secondary uncertainty is when it does happen, how big is it likely to be? So for different kinds of buildings, different kinds of occupancies, of which there's lots, the models have inbuilt a vulnerability curve saying what the damage is likely to be and variability around that. The models handle secondary uncertainty differently. And then the finance module, which is once you've got all these outputs, how are you dealing with that? And there can be reinsurance structures that the models don't necessarily handle, where you might need to do something off-piece to handle that. So these are the kind of things that actuaries probably need to be thinking about. Is, you know, is there anything about the program that you're buying that makes the model not necessarily apply? Has somebody thought about that? Has there been an approximation put in that perhaps needs to be tested under stressful situations? And it can lead to management action or changes. But really, the uncertainty is because the phenomenon that we're measuring is really hard. So we just heard about the ENSO one. It might be the most predictable weather event, but it's still not necessarily predictable. And there can be real uncertainty in these earthquake models too. So have a go here. This is my favourite slide, actually. It's a really good... if actuaries were interested in getting involved, I'd certainly read this paper, where this is earthquake scientists and engineers saying that they don't agree with the way hazard maps are created at the moment. They think they're all wrong. I mean, it's quite dramatic, but things can go wrong are all the physics of understanding. So this is Tohoku, Japan, where this is a plot of the last... it's all the earthquakes since 1979 where 10 or more people have been injured. Now, the earthquake hazard map, the red parts on the south coast are where it's high risk. The yellow parts are where it's low risk. What you notice about that is all of those earthquakes happened not in the red. So if it was a 50-50 chance, which is not, that would be a 1 in 500 chance of that map being correct. So it's unusual. So there's real uncertainty in there. In fact, Tohoku is quite interesting. The seawall was built assuming the biggest earthquake you could get was an 8, because at the time and at the information they used, the tectonic plates, the movements, the type of rocks, they thought an 8 was the biggest you could get. In fact, turned out to be a 9. So they built the seawalls 10 metres tall to allow for an 8. It was a 9. The seawalls were 20 metres tall. So, you know, the models are really uncertain because the actual Earth is uncertain. So let's bring it closer to home. This is a map of all the earthquakes that have happened in the last 160 years in Australia. The reason I draw this is because... I don't draw it, actually. It's from a good source of Australian maps, where they plot some of these in more detail, actually. But there's fault lines, which are those dark lines, and there's the dots. The bigger dots represent different sizes of earthquakes. You can see there's a lot of randomness in there, and we're not even on a fault line, as you can see where the fault line is. It's where all that action happens. So you get earthquakes that happen without a fault line. You get fault lines without earthquakes. It really, really is uncertain. So there's different views. I mean, that's our data. That's the fundamental problem with earthquake, is there isn't enough data. And if you go and ask the earthquake engineers that, you know, say I was to give you 100,000 years on the San Andreas Fault, they'd still say that's probably not enough, because there's lots of randomness in there. I mean, fundamentally, it's chaotic. You know, you dig up to find out when a historic earthquake happened and look at the rocks. You do that 20 metres further away, you get a different answer. There's different ways, there's measurement risk. I mean, there's proper uncertainty here. And we, as the insurance industry, on the back of that. So it leads to us. I'm suggesting here that we don't, as actuaries, necessarily go too far into the models, because the models are complex and built by firms with a lot of money and a lot of expertise. We are users of the model. So our primary role is, has it been used appropriately? Is it a good measure of the risk? Is it getting better or worse? What can we do about it? So one of the ways of doing that would be realistic disaster scenarios, where we all know the 1 in 200 PML is a number off a curve. It's not an event, so it's different. So what we're doing here with these realistic disaster scenarios is picking an actual event and seeing what happens. So there's no reason why you shouldn't do it for all perils. And what it can do is we can pick an event, put it somewhere, see what happens. We can even rerun past events. So if Sydney hail was to move up a little bit, down a little bit, is there anything significant that might happen? And APRA seems to mention stress and scenario testing as well. I'm quite a fan of them. And they've been around in Lloyd's for a long, long time. I mean, Lloyd's have got, I think they've got 13 compulsory scenarios covering a range of topics, including aircraft collisions, which were used before World Trade Center. So it can take into account real things. And part of the use of them to me is it boards understand them, they can start asking questions, and it can lead to doing something different. You know, writing business, if there's uncertainty around Perth and earthquakes and it might cause you a problem, don't write it there. Put your prices up. Put a sublimit in. Go and buy some more cover. Go and do something about it. So realistic disaster scenarios, typically they give you a definition of what it is. So I'll do an example in a minute, with a footprint and a market loss. So all the Lloyd's ones, they give a little bit of a brief description of what happened. They give you some information of a footprint or the airlines or whoever was involved in whatever. And then what you do is you apply it to your portfolio. So I think it's quite important to know exactly what we mean about a realistic disaster scenario. So here's an example of a cyclone, happens to be in Brisbane, showing a hypothetical example of Will Gardner actually wrote a great paper on how to work out or how to come up with a method of picking disaster scenarios, which we refer to in the paper. But if we say a 1 in 200 event for cyclone is about 13.7 billion, and I've run that past the CAT modelling firms and they didn't say no, they didn't say yes, but I think it's reasonable. On this hypothetical example, we can see how much of a loss XYZ would get versus what their share of exposure is. So it could highlight possibly anti-selection. Possibly their rates don't take into account closeness to coast or something. I mean, we can apply it to when you do it with bushfires and storms and hail, basically we're looking at what would the impact be? Does that challenge your program or not? Evidence of anti-selection could be there, and also it can start making you think about how many claims that might be. How might your claims team handle that? Have you got some provisions in place to make sure that you've got enough money to pay for them? Reputation risk, etc. So, you know, from a board point of view, it makes things seem a lot more real than a number off a PML curve. So this is other ways of dealing with the uncertainty. Firstly, is appreciate that they're there. I think, we probably know that now, that just because an answer comes out of a model, I mean, it happens in all our models, our reserving models, just because an answer pops out doesn't necessarily mean that's the end of it. So make sure it's there. Make sure you know where it's coming from. Maybe use more than one model. I think using one model, as long as you understand exactly what you're doing, is actually fine. Using lots of different models is fine too. But make sure you know what you're doing. I think blending in alternative methods as scenarios and stress testings is actually really useful. Workshops where you talk about it, because there might be things that you could do to your policy documents to change the outcome even when you run the same model. So I think it's worth knowing that. And then reverse stress testing. How big an event could you handle? Is there anywhere where that event could happen that is a problem for you? In which case, do something about that. And hopefully your disaster recovery isn't what our friend Dilbert's doing. Because actually, I was at the... I just joined my nice new Lloyd's Syndicate Amlin in September 2001, and quite comfortable. It's the biggest Lloyd's Syndicate, very comfortable. My wife rang me up and told me, you never guess what, there's a plane flown into the World Trade Center building. And I tell you, that Dilbert picture is exactly what happened next, because we had that plane, and we knew that was a total straight away. And then we went round, gathered all the underwriters together who started to pull their hair out and listed everything that was possibly impacted. So this is, I mean, it's not a cat scenario as such, but it's a scenario. We had the planes, we had the buildings, we had the security firms that let people on the planes, we had the cars. It was a nightmare. We had both towers, actually, and that was silly risk management. But it's partly these workshops can really help you do something about it, because if you see something, you've got time to do it, because you're doing it in advance of the event in real life. So the ways of dealing with it is avoid, mitigate, reduce, transfer. I mean, you know, if actually you want to take the front foot, then I think some of these things we need to start saying. I'm a big fan of seeing the outcome of a cat model and seeing what could be different and what you might want to do strategically to avoid that outcome. So it's not just buying more reinsurance or getting more capital, and that's absolutely a last resort. Why not change the front end? Why not impact your pricing? Make sure you're not getting selected against in the way you're pricing your hazard peril as well. So it can lead to more interesting work, I think. So, I mean, the note's quite high level, as I've said, not finished yet. It's getting close. I think we've got a meeting this week to make sure it happens, where we're going to cover some of those more methods in a bit more detail. But would it make any difference? I'd like the answer to be yes. So what I've done here is try to have a go with Christchurch. So what happened was it was a fault line that we didn't know about. And the model gave a very, very low probability of an event happening in Christchurch, partly because it was a fault line we didn't know about. So the hazard map was likely to be wrong. And then beyond that, there was liquefaction. It's worth saying in Tohoku as well, there was a landslide underwater, which no one had really thought about. So that wouldn't have been in the hazard map either. So there's things that, and there's, you know, I'm tempted to say there's always something new. I think there's likely to be something we didn't know after every event. And what happens, I think it's called Texas sharpshooting, where you shoot at a barn and then draw a circle around it and say how good a shot you were. I think there's a temptation to say for cat modelling, yes, we understand that it's now included. But I think the RDSs can really help that if, I've actually done this for somebody actually, that if you'd have realised that Christchurch was a significant exposure for your company and you happened to have picked an RDS, then there is an event, even in the RMS event set, that happens around Christchurch. And you can then apply that to this portfolio. And what you're doing in the RDS is severing that probability link. So effectively, if you think of that probability that the earthquakes experts have used without knowing there was a fault line and use that as you're waiting for that event, no wonder Christchurch probably was more than you expected. If you'd have done this, the model and the event in there is actually pretty good. So I would like to think that using alternative methods can allow you to step away from that model and allow you to make changes, which might be do less exposure in Christchurch, diversify more, buy more protection, sublimit your policies. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do if you're aware of the problem. So I think the key point of this is the leading to action of doing something rather than just there's a number. So I think it's a proactive role for risk management. So I think that's quite an exciting opportunity for actuaries to get involved. I think this is a Will Gardner quote, a fool with a tool is still a fool. So There's no necessary answer. I mean, you still need your brain power and your thinking, thinking literally laterally with the help of other people. But hopefully the notes will be helpful. So hopefully the questions, you can flesh out some things that perhaps we've not covered, but we are trying to be helpful. I'm now going to hand over to Nick, who's going to give us some real-life example.
Afternoon. Thanks, Jeremy. So the ways which CAT models are utilised by companies will vary a lot between different companies. Some larger companies, smaller companies, companies which have wide geographic coverage across many different countries, and some which are state-focused. So there'll be different considerations between different companies. So the note is deliberately not specific, so it covers it, well, it tries to cover every company. But just to put some of the points raised by Jeremy into context, I'm going to give an example of QBE. So the sort of work I'm involved in and some of the things we consider when we look at CAT models. So if anyone's not aware of QBE, a bit of background is we're a relatively large insurer. We cover multiple lines. GWP in Australia is about $4.7 billion, and we're actually part of a wider global group, which is about $18 billion. We cover many classes of business. Within the property area, we do commercial, residential, motor, a variety of companies we insure, so it comes up with various challenges for us. We have a global structure of our CAT modelling team, so we have teams in Australia, in Europe, and in North America, and we interact together and share knowledge and experience, which is beneficial for analysing catastrophes. We also, we internally license CAT models as well. So when using CAT models, as with any type of analysis, good quality data is essential. So as per the APRA documentation, it's required to be consistent, accurate, and complete. Therefore, when we get the data used for CAT modelling, we run multiple checks on it, reconcile between the systems, and compare against previous years and explain any differences. It's very, very important to understand your data, because understanding the data will actually help you understand what model would be appropriate for the data as well. So you might have aggregate data and you'll be looking at a model which needs detailed data, so then you probably need to gather some more information or maybe look at different ways of assessing the catastrophe risk. The selection models will also depend on a number of issues, depending on what perils you need to look at, again, at what areas you're insuring in, what models are available. Jeremy gave a list of the different perils which are covered. Not all perils are always covered, and sometimes those models might not be appropriate, or you need to maybe look at additional areas for analysis to give you a complete assessment of the hazard. So as we license the CAT models in-house at QBE, we're able to actually do lots of investigations ourselves. We have access to resources from the CAT modelling companies, which helps us in our selections of models. So when we get the results, it's important to really go through those, break them down into smaller components, really understand what the models are saying, and also how that relates back to the data. So there's kind of a feedback, you can identify potential areas where you might have gaps or limitations in the data and analysis, and you might need to go back to your data and improve it. So looking at model sensitivity is an area which you can look into to help try and understand the model output. This is just giving some examples here. So this is relative to the unknown option or the industry average. So with one as the average, you can see that year built, if it's very old building, you get a lot higher losses. So if you suspect your portfolio might have older buildings than normal, but you don't know any of the year builds, then you probably need to investigate more. Whereas if you think the majority of your portfolio is actually built around 1990, then that's probably maybe not a bigger issue. Maybe there might be other issues, say with the number of stories. If you've got like taller buildings than average, you can see that the models are very sensitive to this area. So this is the sort of thing which you can look at to help you understand the model output. And you know, the catastrophe risk associated with that. So we engage with various experts. We work well with our reinsurance brokers. We have experts in-house as well who can look into these things and help us there. So as Jeremy mentioned, there is other alternatives to looking at catastrophe risk other than CAT models, and it's very important to look at things from a range of perspectives. Something we use very extensively in QBE is RDSs. So we've used these for over 10 years. The pictures on the right kind of illustrate some of the things to look at. So earthquakes is one of the more obvious things to look at. It's often very hard to understand the CAT model, what it represents, whereas an RDS makes it a bit more tangible. We also look at pandemics. So we've recently looked at the Ebola outbreak in West Africa using RDSs, just trying to understand what sort of policies it can impact. And one of the major kind of success stories we've had from using RDSs in the past is we looked at our infectious diseases. Infectious diseases, we actually had clauses in our contracts where we looked at the RDSs and we said if a certain set of events happened, we could actually be liable for a lot of claims, and so that then led to policy changes. So it's really kind of a real life feedback from the benefits of using RDSs. But I would say that they are subjective and they're not, you know, the answer to everything either. So also exposure analysis, again coming back to data, it's very important to have good quality data. You can look at exposure analysis. We also use DFA tools which help us further analyse catastrophe models and look at different scenarios as well, and also potentially put adjustments through in the CAT models where there might be gaps or limitations on there. So I think that's a very brief example of sort of things we look at, and I think it's time for questions. So.
Thanks. If you have questions, if you can talk into the microphone, please, as it's being recorded.
Bill Gardner, Combus. You mentioned earlier on, Jeremy, that this is not a guidance note. What is the working party's thoughts on, you know, putting together a professional standard or a guidance note? Is that necessary? Is it not going to happen? What do you guys think?
I think Susan's probably better to answer that than me.
I think the problem with putting together a professional standard or guidance note is the level at which it applies. So an information note is just an initial way that the Institute can provide some guidance for actuaries. If it turns out that this becomes much bigger and much more of a focus from APRA, then maybe we relook at it. But it's pretty much like the other accumulations. It's something APRA's asking us to do. There is no one-size-fits-all. It's just a bit harder, and APRA isn't as prescriptive on exactly what you have to do. It says you have to do certain things. Looking at CAT models is one way of actually doing that, because most companies will use CAT models to set up their ICRC, determine their reinsurance programs. But it's very hard to come up with a professional standard unless there is a really specific legislative requirement. It also puts a lot more onus on the Institute. And so the tendency of the Institute is, unless it's a specific legislative or regulatory requirement, it's done as an information note, especially when there's a lot of scope for differences of opinion and differences of approach.
Any more questions from the audience? Thanks. Well, we'll wrap that up. Please join me in thanking Jeremy and Nick.